two films, one theme. This is Words and Movies.
Thank you very much, Alex, and welcome to the next episode of Words and Movies, or should I say the previous episode of Words and Movies. Yeah, we had ourselves a little data issue, and it's I can't blame Sean for anything. It was entirely on me, all right? I was doing a thing, and the file corrupted, and now here we are having to re-record. And so I apologize to Sean. I apologize to you for screwing you guys up with everything out of order, but here we are. Who am I? Oh, yeah, I'm your co-host, Claude Call.
And I'm your other co-host, Sean Gallagher. So the episode we are re-recording is episode 9 in our Around the World series. And this is an episode that has two movies that take a look at how we are basically all living on one planet called capitalism and how that affects a lot of people in not so good ways. And the two movies that we'll be talking about are from 2018 from Japan, Shoplifters, written and directed by Hirokazu Koreeda. And from 2019, from South Korea, Parasite, directed and co-written by Bong Joon-ho. Now, in addition to being both movies about the negative effects of capitalism and both dealing with poor families, both movies also happened to win the Palme d'Or at the Cannes Film Festival the year they were entered, and both movies were nominated that same year at the Oscars for Best Non-English Language Film. Shoplifters lost to a movie we covered early on in this series, Roma, and as a matter of fact, the beginning of the Around the World series, and Parasite won. And we'll talk about that more when we talk about Parasite, but right now, Claude is going to give us the plot description for Shoplifters.
Yes, I am. So we open on a middle-aged man and a boy, about 10 or 11 years old, and they're at a grocery store in Tokyo. The man is Osamu, and the boy is Shota. As they walk around the store, they separate, and they begin sending silent signals to one another. At one point, we see Shota look around himself, then he twiddles his index fingers together and touches the back of his hand to his lips and nose. This is his way of priming himself for what he's about to do. Then, he slips a package of food into his book bag. A minute later, we see Osamu, who is pretending to be shopping, run visual interference while Shota steals some more food. The two of them then exit the store undetected. Osamu's reasoning for the theft is, as he's told Shota, it's fine to steal things that have not been sold because they don't belong to anyone. On their way home that evening, they note how cold it is when they hear a noise. Osamu recognizes the sound because he's heard it before. It's a small girl named Yuri out on the porch of her home and in the cold. He lures her out with some food and they take her home. In the next scene, we meet the rest of the family. First up is Hatsui. She's an elderly woman who owns the home and supports them with her deceased husband's pension. Everybody calls her grandma, so I'm going to do the same here. We also learn that she's pretending to live alone so that she won't get kicked out by the landlord. Next, we have Nobuyu, who is Osamu's wife. She works for an industrial laundry service. Osamu himself, he's a day laborer when he's not out stealing stuff. And finally, there's Aki, a young woman in her early 20s who works at a fetish club. We learn later on that Aki isn't contributing what she makes to the household because she cut some kind of deal with grandma. Osamu and grandma take quickly to Yuri and ply her with food since she's clearly underweight. Nobuyu says she needs to go home right away, but Osamu says it's too cold and we'll take her home the next day. However, Nobuyu is adamant. Grandma, meanwhile, notices an injury on Yuri's arm, and Yuri's explanation is that she fell. Then she notes that Yuri has several marks on her. Later that night, Osamu carries a sleeping Yuri back to her home, accompanied by Nobuyu. When they get to the house, they hear shouting from inside. The adults inside are blaming each other for Yuri's disappearance, but it's also clear that neither of them wants the responsibility for her. Osamu and Nobuyu decide they can't put her back into an abusive situation, and they take her back home. Shota goes to work and injures his ankle, meaning he'll be out of work for at least a month, and there's no workers' comp for day laborers. The entire family is underemployed, which is why they resort to shoplifting to keep themselves, in food and whatever. And this isn't helping matters. Yuri starts to bond with her new family and learns the gentle art of shoplifting from Osamu and Shota. Osamu urges Shota to see him as his father and Yuri as his sister, but Shota is reluctant to do so. In fact, Shota appears to be growing a little bit of a conscience, and he suggests that they don't need Yuri's help to get the jobs done. Osamu notes that it just makes it easier for her to live with them. Later that night, Shota is late getting to the house, and Yuri waits outside for him. Nobuyu observes one night that for a child of abuse, Yuri is rather sweet, wondering why she doesn't turn out to be like us, as she describes it. During a late-night conversation with Osamu, Shota tells him about the children's story Swimmy, which is about a school of small fish who band together to beat up a large tuna. The two play in the street, chasing each other around. The family learns on television that after almost 2 months, now police are investigating Yuri's disappearance. Apparently, her parents never reported her missing, and now they're considered suspects. They also learn that her name is Juri, not Yuri. They consider sending her home, but Yuri really wants to stay. The family cuts her hair, burns her old clothes, and renames her Lynn. However, I'm going to keep calling her Yuri to keep the story straight. Aki tells Yuri that she has another name too, and tells Yuri it's Sayaka, which is the name she uses in the fetish club. The next day, the children are walking to a department store with Grandma and Nobuyu. Grandma's a little surprised that Yuri chose to stay, but Nobuyu isn't, noting that it's good to have family that you choose. Grandma says, "I chose you too." Back at the house, Aki asks Osamu when he and Nobuyu get to have sex. Osamu says, "They're past that. They're connected in their hearts." Then he asks Aki how she thinks they're connected, and Aki says, "Oh, it's a money thing." Back in the store, the women are picking out some new clothes for Yuri, and of course, they're figuring out ways to boost the clothes from the store. Later that evening, Nobuyu and Yuri are in the bathroom. Yuri has just had a bath, and now Nobuyu is in the tub. Yuri notices a mark on Nobuyu's arm. She says it was an accident from work when she burned herself with a hot iron. Yuri shows off her arm and says she did the same thing. Nobuyu just accepts the lie, but later tries to explain that if her family truly loved her, they wouldn't hurt her, they would hug her instead. Shota and Yuri are in a shop. Shota runs interference while Yuri steals something, but the shop owner stops them and instead of making a big deal about it, gives Shota a treat for the two of them and says he shouldn't make his sister do that stuff. Meanwhile, Nobuyu is told that either she or another worker has to be laid off from the laundry, and the boss leaves it between them regarding which one it's going to be, which, let's face it, is kind of a crappy way for a boss to handle these things. Well, it turns out that the co-worker is wise to Yuri, so Nobuyu is the one who's out. Grandma visits her husband's son from an affair. She regularly receives money from these visits. The son and his wife, it turns out, are Aki's parents. They're maintaining a lie that their daughter is living in Australia, and we briefly meet Aki's sister, the real Sayaka, who is an honors student at her school. Meanwhile, Abi is at work with a regular customer whom she calls Mr. Four. She arranges for a face-to-face meeting as opposed to the ones they've been doing to that point, which involves her acting the naughty schoolgirl from behind one-way glass. The meeting is him lying on the floor with his head in her lap while she caresses him and says encouraging things. Instead, she starts opening up about herself when she notices that Mr. Four has marks on his hand. He says it's from self-inflicted injuries. Their time is up, but Aki pulls him back into a face-to-face hug. It's summer by now, and we see Osamu is eating cold noodles with Nobuyu. Because it's hot, she's wearing only underwear and a negligee. She says she lost her job, and he thinks it's because she stole something, and she agrees, well, he's half right anyway. It begins to rain, and she seduces him. Later, they're enjoying the afterglow when they hear Shota and Yuri coming in from the rain. Osamu stalls and distracts them while Nobuyu gets dressed. We get a scene where Osamu is doing magic tricks for the kids, but Nobuyu is spoiling the illusions for them. When Osamu sends Yuri for a deck of cards, Shota tells him what happened in the store. Osamu says it's too early for her to do something else, which goes unsaid. Shota ponders this as he contemplates the ruined magic trick. A little while later, the entire family goes out on the porch to listen to fireworks that they can't see. Osamu spends a little bit of time describing these unseen fireworks. The family visits the beach. Shota is inflating a float, but he's briefly distracted by Aki's breast jiggling as she applies sunscreen. A few minutes later, while out on the water, Osamu calls him out on it, but it's a charming coming-of-age conversation rather than an attempt to embarrass the boy. Grandma, who's sitting on the beach with Nobuyu, looks at the rest of the family playing in the water. She expresses contentment that she will not die a lonely death. Nobuyu joins the others, and Grandma offers silent thanks to them all. At home that night, she dies in her sleep. Osamu and Nobuyu bury her under the house in order to avoid reporting her death so that they can continue to collect her pension and live in the house. And as he's washing up afterwards, Osamu expresses disbelief that they're burying another one, quote-unquote. Nobuyu says, this time it's different. A few nights later, Nobuyu and Osamu are scavenging the house looking for money that Grandma stashed. Shota sees this, and he appears a little bit disturbed by it. A short time after that, Osamu breaks into a car and steals a purse. This makes Shota feel uneasy, since he considers this theft against their moral code. Shota recalls joining the family after Nobuyu and Osamu found him in a locked car and wonders aloud if they found him because they were going to steal from that car too. But Osamu denies it. He says he broke into that car specifically to rescue Shota. Yuri and Shota go back to a familiar store to do a shoplifting job, but it's closed. There's a sign on the door suggesting that there's been a death in the family, but neither of them understand its meaning. Shota thinks maybe the store went bankrupt because he stole from them. They go to a different store, and as he's about to take something, he spots Yuri engaging in those same hand gestures he uses before he steals. So he interrupts her theft by stealing fruit in full view of the staff. He runs out, and they pursue him, where they manage to corner him on a bridge. He jumps off the bridge to escape, but instead he breaks his leg. Shota is hospitalized and detained by police. Nobuyu and Osamu are caught after attempting to flee with Yuri and Aki. And this is where the whole scam starts to really unravel, and we learn the whole picture through a series of scenes involving various authorities speaking with each family member individually. Yuri is identified, and the death of Grandma is discovered. They tell Shota that the family was going to abandon him. They reveal to Aki that Nobuyu and Osamu previously killed Nobuyu's abusive husband in a crime of passion, though it was ruled as self-defense, and they also tell her that Grandma has been receiving money from Aki's parents. Aki's mostly confused that her parents actually know where she is, but then she's hurt that her relationship with Grandma was financial in nature. Osamu tells the police that their intent in taking Yuri was rescuing her from abuse, and in fact, we see a brief interview between her parents and the press, and the parents clearly know nothing about her. In fact, they're even lying to the reporters about Yuri being asleep. Nobuyu takes all the blame for the illegal burial in order to protect Osamu, who has a previous criminal record, and she is sentenced to prison. But during the interview, she briefly debates the police officer about the nature of family. It's clear that she feels maternal toward the kids, but when she's asked what they call her, she has a long, sad moment of contemplation and doesn't answer directly. Aki goes back to the house, now unoccupied, of course, but it's also a mess, having been ransacked by the cops. She sees this from the doorway and never actually sets foot inside. Shota is placed in an orphanage. He and Osamu visit Nobuyu in prison one day, and she gives Shota details of the car they found him in so he can search for his parents if he so chooses. Shota spends the night with Osamu against the orphanage rules. When Shota asks, Osamu tells him the truth, confirming they did intend to abandon him, and says, "I can no longer be your father." The next morning, as he's about to depart, Shota confesses that he allowed himself to be caught. Osamu runs after Shota's bus. Shota looks back and finally acknowledges Osamu as his father, but of course, Osamu never hears it. Yuri is returned to her parents, who continue to neglect her, and the last thing we see is her alone on the cold porch again, singing a song she had learned with the family and looking out toward the house that she shared with them.
Okay, so let's talk about Hirokazu Koreeda. Times of blockbuster movies and, other types of movies, being called a humanist filmmaker can often be seen in some circles as a put-down. But nonetheless, Hirokazu Koreeda is a humanist filmmaker, and from the films of his that I've seen, which admittedly is not all of them, he's quite a good one. I first got turned on to him by Roger Ebert when he prays to the high heavens Corrieta's first feature movie, Ma Barossi, which I have not yet had a chance to rewatch. But I've seen a number of others that he's done, and although sometimes he can be a little low-key for his own good, mostly, again, I've liked his movies, except for Afterlife, which is about, which takes place at a way station, so to speak, and is about newly dead people trying to remember or think of what their best memory or the memory they want to take with them is. And then the people at the way station try and make a film about it. And that's a little allegorical, but it works. But most of his other movies are basically slice of life humanist dramas. Things like Still Walking, Our Little Sister, Like Father, Like Son, and a lot of, and Nobody Knows, which is, along with Like Father, Like Son, one of the movies that Corrieta has said is most similar to Shoplifters, and that they all are about the theme, what constitutes the family. And in more manipulative hands, they might come off as soap operas, but instead they come off as very powerful and affecting. And of the movies that Corrieta had made up to that point, I think that Shoplifters is the best of them. How about you, Claude? Did you find this powerful and affecting as well?
I really did. And not only that, but as you said, he kind of low-keys everything. But that works out really well, I think, in this case. You know, there are so many subtleties going on here. And, you know, I don't want to, like, hammer in that this is a re-recording. But I did a rewatch just for this. And you know, again, I was just struck by so many funky little details that really, you know, whether it was character, like actors choosing to do this for their character or something that he asked them to do, but there was just like, it's not as though, like, for instance, like Shota sees this one event and says, oh, this is wrong and we can't drag Yuri into it. You see, like, it's building little by little, and what's more, it's part of his maturity process. So, you know, he starts to see, like, this might not be right. This is thing, and he sees that Osamu is escalating the level of the crimes, and that's kind of bugging him because, hey, we got a code and we're breaking it. But it's all tiny, tiny, tiny little increments that come up, and you can see each time it's like bugging him just a little bit more until finally he sees Yuri getting sucked into it. And he says, I got to put a stop to this. And I just like the way things like that were handled. And then also similarly, you know, you're not too deep into the film when you realize that this isn't a family in the traditional sense. It's just like little things that everybody's saying from time to time. So again, low key, but it works so, so fabulously well.
And again, what constitutes a family.
Yeah.
Now, Ebert included, a lot of reviewers have compared Corrieta to the acclaimed Japanese filmmaker Yasujirō Ozu, who was also known for making movies exclusively about families. Now, if you ask Corrieta about this, not so much. He has said that his influences are a director that we talked about in this Around the World series, Mikio Naruse, and then also Ken Loach, a British director who is known for making social realist dramas and movies that are explicitly political. Now, although I happen to agree with Loach's politics, as far as his filmmaking goes, he can get overly schematic at times. Like, he's afraid that if he doesn't jerry-rig the movies just right, that we won't root for the people or root for the message the way that he wants us to. And you never get that with Corrieta. And one way you can see that is not just the subtlety, but the way he handles the child actors. Now, since we've mentioned Shota and Yuri a couple times here, Shota is played by, and I know I'm going to mess this up, Jayo Kairi, where Yuri is played by Mio Sasaki. And the way that Corrieta deals with child actors is that he does not give them a script at all. And he films them with a discrete camera. The cinematographer on this movie, by the way, was Kondo Ryudo. And they just... you know, he doesn't make a big deal, apparently doesn't make a big deal about, you know, saying action or cut, or maybe he does, but does say those words, that is. But, you know, he sets things up so that the children don't feel any pressure at all and allows them to act natural. And certainly the way the two of them act is natural, so you believe that they are actual kids rather than child actors. And that last scene in the store when Yuri is doing those hand signals and Shota comes to that decision is a perfect example. I mean, admittedly, it's something that's been built up for the previous part of the movie, but without the way that the two of them are performing that scene, it wouldn't work as powerfully as it does.
Yeah, I think you're right, and it seems to me that he for the most part, he's really not getting into anybody's face with the camera too much. But especially with the youngsters, you can see even when they're like alone in a shot, you know, it's still kind of a medium shot. It's from the waist up. It's a little bit distant, except for one shot that I remember in particular. And it's the one where she loses her tooth, where Yuri loses a tooth. And this hasn't happened to her before. She doesn't know what to do. So she comes and finds Shota and they go through this bit about, you know, how you got to throw it up on the roof and whatever else. But there is that one close-up where she looks almost directly into the camera and does this great big smile showing the little gap in her face, which is just an adorable, adorable picture.
Yes, it is. Now, again, Corrieta said in interviews that he wasn't trying to make a tract here, that he was just trying to make a story about what constitutes a family. While unlike Like Father, Like Son, which was inspired by a real case of families getting the wrong baby out of the hospital on the same day, or Nobody Knows, which was about a mother leaving her children behind in an apartment and them being forced to fend for themselves, there was no specific news story that was the basis for this movie. Corrieta did read quite a few stories about people who pretended that older relatives were still alive so that they could continue to collect their government money from them. And then also he visited an orphanage and saw a little girl reading the book Swimming, just and that inspired the scene in the movie where a character reads Swimming. But at the same time, you know, this is a movie that shows, you know, anger about Japan's social services. And how, you know, the fact that Shota and Yuri have clearly not been done right by the Japanese system of government, considering that the reason that they were both taken away is that they were both in abusive family situations. And also, Nobuyu, as you mentioned, having an abusive husband. And by the way, Nobuyu is played by Sakawa Ando, but at the same time, he's not trying to demonize the Sakura Ando, excuse me. At the same time, Koreeda is not trying to demonize the government officials who come in when everything unravels. You know, clearly they are trying to do the right thing by everyone. It's just that unfortunately they're four or five steps behind what's really going on.
Right. They're perfectly good people. They're perfectly caring people. Once they've got a handle on this is a situation, they take swift action to take care of it. But it's not just like the youngsters who are falling through the cracks. You've also got like the, you know, issues with the pension system. You've got issues with the workers' comp system. Okay, because he's a day laborer, he doesn't get the workers' comp. And,
right.
You know, and so that turns into a bad situation for him. And if you're already in the position of being a day laborer where you're not working on a regular basis, well, this is just going to set you that much further back. And again, low key, he's not hitting you over the head with it, but you realize, you know, if a bunch of things had gone in a slightly different way, these people would all be in better shape.
And then the boss leaving it between Nobuyu and her coworker as to who's going to get the other job.
Well, that was just extra jerk store. So, yeah.
Yes. But, you know, it did put me in the whole thing did put me in mind of a first season Law and Order episode where a young girl is beaten to death ultimately by her parents, and the detectives who at the time were Detective Logan and Sergeant Greavy visit the New York City's social services, whatever, Child Welfare Board, whatever the agency is called. And they said, you know, they made one visit and Logan gets very upset about that. And then the woman he talks to presses a button on the computer screen and hundreds of names start running down the computer screen. And she said, this is all just New York City. Last I heard, we had, you know, thousands of cases or whatever number in New York State alone. We kind of have our hands full, you know, which unfortunately is true. And then the other thing that our movie that or media related thing that the movie reminded me of was Gone Baby Gone, Ben Affleck's adaptation of the Dennis Lehane novel, which is not as good a movie, I think, as this one is for a lot of reasons, but they both have a gut punch of an ending where a little girl who is taken out of an abusive situation, kidnapped out of an abusive situation, I should say, but is staying with loving parents. And the main character, private detective, calls the police when he finds out and she's taken away. And you're left wondering at the end whether he did the right thing for the little girl, bringing her back to her abusive and neglectful in this case, more neglectful mother. And, you know, when you've got a moral dilemma like that you're presenting in the movie, and you don't offer any easy answers at the end, that's all to the good, as this movie shows.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I mean, you do feel for, well, Jury, not Yuri, but it's, I mean, it is the reality of the situation, and you know, unfortunately, not everything gets wrapped up in a tidy little bow. Even though we did get like some, you know, reasonably complete endings for most of the other characters in this film. Well, Grandma's dead. That's one thing, you know. Shota and Osamu, they might have a future together as you know, a continuing relationship. You know, that kind of remains to be seen. But at the same time, we do have that closure where he does call him dad. You know, Aki is a little bit up in the air. Maybe she got together with Mr. Four and is having a wonderful life. And, you know, maybe not. But she is at least, you know, a reasonably like self-realized young adult, and, you know, understands the relationship between grandma and her parents and is able to move forward from there, it seems.
Right. Now, as far as the other actors go, I want to make quick mention of three folks here. Kieran Kiki, who played the grandmother. This was one of her last movies. She died not long before this movie came out. She was also in Corrieta's Our Little Sister and Like Father, Like Son. And let's see if she was in anything else that... and in Still Walking, and she also voiced one of the more famous anime movies, The Secret World of Arrietty, not directed by Hayao Miyazaki, but co-written by him. And she's done a lot of other movies. She's one of the folks who, if you're familiar with Corrieta's work, you would be familiar with her face, even though she's done, as I said, a lot of other things that Japanese audiences would know. The other actor who has worked with Corrieta a lot, who is in this movie, is Lily Frankie, who plays Osamu. And although he was, you know, he was good in Like Father, Like Son as well, that movie, I have to admit, is a little more jerry-rigged than most of other Corrieta's movies, even though I like it. Well, I mean, it seems more schematic because I mentioned that Like Father, Like Son was about two families whose babies were swapped at the hospital when the mothers gave birth the same day. And one family is upper class, and the other family, of whom Lily Frankie plays the father, is lower class. And at times it seems like Corrieta's trying to score points off of the upper class family to contrast them with the lower class family. And, you know, in the movie we're going to discuss next, everyone is good and bad, you know, and also it's not played for naturalistic humanist drama, so that's okay. But since Like Father, Like Son is supposed to be played as realistic naturalistic humanist drama, it does stick out a little more. So while Frankie was good, I don't think he comes off as well-rounded as he does in this movie, where, you know, he's done good things, he's done bad things, but at the same time, you understand him every single step of the way, which is thanks to the writing and thanks to his performance.
Yeah, because if he's not necessarily transparent to the other people in the scene, he kind of makes his intentions and his thoughts clear to us, the viewer, which I really appreciated from him. That's not always easy to do. So, you know, there are times when you can tell he's, you know, lying to another character and maybe even to himself a little bit. But we get that's what he's up to, even earlier in the film when we don't know him especially well. And I guess similarly, it's kind of funny. It's only like on the second watch that this kind of crossed my mind. But in the scene where, you know, he and his wife have sex and they almost get caught by the kids coming in out of the rain, you know, he's. Well, first there's the scene with him and Aki where she's like, you know, how do you guys have sex with everybody in the house? And he's like, we don't really need that. And then later on when where he is seduced by his wife and they have sex and there's a little bit of afterglow and whatever else, and he's saying like, hey, I did it, and it's like, wait a minute, did this guy have a problem with this at some point? You know, and that wasn't something that necessarily occurred to me on the first watch. So I thought that was kind of cool, and in the sense that, you know, he actually conveyed like maybe multiple levels of that, not just that, you know, we got it done, we managed to have sex, but like, I'm not typically able to, but I was able to this time.
Okay, so, and then I also want to just briefly mention that Sakura Ando, who plays, as I mentioned before,
Nobuyo,
and then also, you know, she's very good. I don't think I had ever seen her before in anything. And then also the actress who plays Aki, Mayu Matsuoka, I think is excellent as well. But everyone in the movie is excellent.
Yeah, let me make a couple of points on those two, if I could. So, you know, Mayu Matsuoka is as Aki, you know, for the most part, she could conceivably just come off as like, you know, the Marilyn to these monsters, right? You know, and she doesn't. She's got like, again, layers of subtlety going on there. And one of the things I especially liked was the scene at the end with the reveal that, you know, her parents know where she is, that there's been a financial agreement between them. And she does this reaction. It's just like a second late, which is like, you know, it's like she processed it and then she went, wait, what? You know? And I was like, that was really, really good. You know, the other thing is with Nobuya Shibata, Sakura, is she's kind of portrayed throughout this film as a little bit on the plain side. And so, you know, she doesn't dress up very often. She's got like kind of a drudgery work where you're working in the laundry, you know, when she's working that, you know, and so she is really kind of downplayed, so that when we get to that scene where she does seduce Osamu, okay, you suddenly realize like, oh my God, the girl's got a bod on her, you know, and she really does have like a nice shape and a nice body and whatever. And it's something like you just didn't necessarily expect, and I liked the way that they managed to bring that out, you know. And I'm sure it's a, you know, it's a little bit of, you know, the way she carries herself and a little bit of wardrobe and whatever else, but it comes off as a neat little surprise. And that scene where the two of them have sex, I mean, we don't see anything, we don't actually even see them having sex. It's like, here's the before and here's the after. And while she is nude face down on the floor, you know, you can still like there you can appreciate it. And like, wow, like this is a transformation. She's gone kind of like from the plain Jane into the Cinderella sort of thing. And then, you know, after that scene, she kind of tones down again. It was just an interesting jump from one section to the next.
Right. So do you have anything else you want to mention before we wrap this up?
Just one more thing that I found kind of interesting, and this comes late in the movie. It's after the meeting with Mr. Four when Aki comes home, and Nobuyu is cooking in the kitchen, and she is wearing a really interesting shirt, and it's easy to read because it's in English. It's a quotation from Martin Luther King Jr., and it's that freedom is never given voluntarily by the oppressor. It must be demanded by the oppressed. And I thought, it's one of these things where you hear stories all the time about, you know, people who are in countries where they don't use the Roman alphabet. And you know, it happens here, too. It's like people get these, you know, cool tattoos, and it's Chinese for Japan or whatever it happens to be, and they really have no idea what it says. And you kind of wonder if she knew what it said because it's in Roman letters rather than in Japanese. But it was just kind of an interesting message for her to be wearing on her body at that point, that these are the oppressed, but she may not necessarily know that that's what the shirt says.
Yes, and that can be the message of both of these movies.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll get to that in the second half of the episode when we talk about Parasite, which is coming right up.
Immediately in your podcast feed, so stick around.